Hey, Clunatics, welcome back to Love Song, the podcast. This is Kurt Graves, and I'm going to be your host for the next four episodes as we interview some of the narrators that bring T.J. Klune's work to life, as well as T.J. Klune himself. I want to start off by saying how incredibly grateful I am to these guys for giving their time to this little pet project of mine. When I decided I wanted to find a way to bring Love Song to audio and to be able to give it to you guys for free, podcasting seemed like the easiest and most accessible way to do that. And once that platform was in place, I thought, well, man, I would love to be able to have some conversations with Derek and Michael and Greg, who I'm a big fan of, and then to just be able to have a one-on-one chat with TJ, which is something that I had never been able to do before. And all of them were so incredibly generous with their time, and they signed on right away. And so I'm just so grateful for them and their generosity. And I hope that you'll take the time when you see them or when you interact with them online to thank them as well. We're kicking off our interview series with Derek McLean, and there's enough of an intro in our actual conversation, so I'll let those of you who aren't familiar with Derek get to know him there. But before we jump into the interview, I did just want to address one thing about a podcast, which is that, you know, the sound quality is different on a podcast than it is for an audiobook. For the first two episodes, I really treated them as an audiobook because you were getting a short story, and I had complete control over the environment that I was recording in, and I could stop and start again if mistakes were made or if background noises got in the way. And so the first two episodes that contain the short story Love Song sound, I hope, like a professional audiobook. From here on out, we're treating the audio more like a podcast. So, one, I don't have control over the environment. We were chatting over Skype. So sometimes background noises or, like, you're going to hear our chairs creak and stuff like that. So please forgive me that there is a difference between the first couple episodes and the episodes moving forward. But just imagine that you are sitting in the room and you get to eavesdrop on these truly great conversations I got to have with these really interesting and incredible people. So I'm going to shut up now and we're going to jump right into our conversation with Derek McLean. I doubt that many people who listen to the podcast are going to need like a formal introduction for you, but for anybody who's listening who's like, who's this dude? You are Derek McLean, and you have, in the Clooniverse, narrated How to Be a Normal Person and Olive Juice. But I see on Audible you have 31 other titles by authors who are not T.J. Klune, but some pretty notable names, including like Jeff Adams, S.J. Himes, Andrew Gray, C.S. Poe. The list goes on and on. And you've also recently started your own business dedicated to audio production, proofing, editing, mastering, and all of that.
Yeah, and that wasn't a crazy idea at all.
I'm sure it wasn't.
That doesn't take up any time.
So that's you in a nutshell for anybody who literally has no idea who you are. Is there anything I'm missing that's really important in your professional bio?
No, okay. That's it.
I narrate, produce, and do other things with audiobooks.
Awesome.
That's my life.
Well, I definitely want to talk about your work. I want to talk about your work with TJ specifically. But more than that, I just want to talk about you. And I want to learn everything there is to know. I'm intensely curious. Right. So let's start at the beginning. Where did you grow up? What was little?
Oh, man, we're going all the way back.
Well, yeah, what was like young?
Little Derek was born in Orange County, California, in the mid-80s. We'll leave it a little vague.
I was also born in the mid-80s. Do we need to worry? Are we that old?
No.
Do we need to be hiding it?
No, we're not.
Okay. I like, you know, because we voice characters who are both young and old, sometimes I like a little mystery.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Exact. But no, yeah, I was born in Southern California. And then when I was five, I moved out to rural Pennsylvania. And then
why?
Because my mom's a serial monogamist. And she and my dad broke up when I was real young, like two. And then when I was five, Well, when I was four, she hooked up with an insurance salesman she met at a Boy Scout function, moved in with him in like the middle of the woods in Pennsylvania. I moved out with them, spent summers visiting my dad. When I was 11, they broke up just after moving to Jacksonville, Florida. One of my stepdads for a brief period of time then was an Australian Marlin, like captain of a Marlin hunting vessel.
Okay.
That was a blast. Then I was down in Jacksonville, Florida, from 11 to 20. And then I sold everything I owned and went on a road trip for about 4 months and wound up homeless in DC. And then I said, I don't like this. So then I moved in with my brother back in Southern California. And then I decided I wanted to be a minister. So I moved back in with my mom in Jacksonville, Florida, and started going to college finally, and was doing a whole bunch of public speaking at different youth retreats and churches. So then and I joined the speech and debate team, and I was going to a little community college, and I was doing that to, you know, hone my public speaking skills, because that was a thing I'd been doing for a couple of years and really enjoyed it. And at the first national tournament, there was this like tall, lanky, very well-spoken, nicely dressed redhead, and I was like, yeah. So we hooked up at the tournament, and then he was from a school in Tallahassee, Florida, after that tournament, we just sort of kept talking. I ended up getting accepted to Oxford. I was going to go study for a degree in philosophy and theology. From community college, which was a pretty sweet, awesome deal. Yeah. Then I kept talking to this redhead and I kind of fell in love with him. So I decided to go to FSU instead.
Oxford of Northern Florida.
The Oxford of Northern Florida. And it was a big gamble, but it was worth it because we got, you know, we're married now.
Hmm.
And that was about 6 years ago. But yeah, and then I started working at a church and I was going to do the minister thing. And I was a youth pastor and I was doing 9:30 early service. Unless you're like in like a big giant mega church, churches actually don't make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And so my pay was very, very small and I needed a little extra income somehow. And, one of the, mothers at the church, she used to be the youth ministry director, and helped me get the position. I knew that she owned a little, publishing company of some sort and, asked her if she had any, you know, if there was any sort of little side work that I could do to help out, just make a little extra income. And she said, yeah, you know, actually we have a backlog of audiobooks that need to get, you know, final proofing to make sure that there's no remaining mistakes. Her name's Elizabeth North. Her publishing company is Dream Spinner Press. And so I started proofing for Dream Spinner and was then sort of exposed both to gay romance, which is what most of my titles are. I keep saying I'm going to break out of genre, but I just keep doing gay romance. I like it. I got exposed to that and I learned a little bit more about how sort of the audiobook world works, and I decided to give a try on the other side of things, and it went fairly well. And meanwhile, things were sort of falling a little apart at church for various personal life reasons, and so I ended up diving into this headlong, and that was I guess a couple years ago. It's been 2 years. I can check the Audible listings. So I'm not as prolific as some of my compatriots, but I am proud of the work that I've done and I'm still doing it and I'm excited about what's to come. So
okay, let's see if I sort your titles by date.
By date, yeah. From where I was born, there I give you the quick synopsis of
You were really good at that, by the way. This is not my first podcast. I've done lots of interviews. You basically answered my next four questions all in that summary. So thanks for that. March 18th of 2015, it looks like, was the first one that got released. So a little over 3 years you've been doing this.
Oh, my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
I need to get more than 10 titles done a year.
Time flies.
Andrew, Andrew's been saying that to me since day one, but
it's hard. It's hard. We'll get into that later. So, I had seen you post on social media. I did what I feel like is a healthy amount of cyber stalking of you before this interview. And I had seen you post on social media that you had met your husband at a speech event. And I was excited to talk to you about that because I was like, ooh, something in common. Because I was a speech geek and a speech coach.
I've seen you post a couple things related to like forensics.
Until this year, I was a forensics coach at the high school I went to. So it's really been a part of my life for almost 20 years. But what I didn't know we had in common was the youth ministry background. I was a youth minister for 6 years.
Look at that.
I know. In the Catholic Church, actually, which was interesting. What faith background were you working in?
It's called Unity, and it's a sort of New Thought, Christian, very spiritual, borderline interfaith. It sort of depends on the particular church that you're involved in.
When I was a different type of person, I used to make fun of that type of religion.
Totally.
I would call that one like the lesbian minister with the twigs and the berry.
That is exactly it.
Here's a blessing glorious. With a tree branch.
No, it's kind of a trip because we would build like labyrinths and walk them based on cathedrals, and we would talk about the disciples, and then we would do yoga and meditation and talk about chakras, and bunch of the kids were into witchcraft, and we're like, yeah, all right, it was a very freewheeling environment, which I really enjoyed, but it just ended up with especially with my husband and life and everything else, sort of a lot of my priorities in life shifted. And so it was something I had to move away from. Now, with the Catholic retreats, were you already deeply familiar with the shark song that's been blowing up on Facebook? I'm a shark,
God, that goes back to like middle school. Student council retreats like that.
People are discovering it for the first time, and I'm like, no.
What?
I've been living with this song for years.
So that's blowing up like now in 2018.
Yeah.
That's insane. Yeah, I know that goes way back to like student council, middle school. We used to do that. But yeah, I know it definitely existed also at the church level.
Yeah.
Which I never got. Like, I was always one of those kids.
Better songs.
Yeah. I only work with teens. I only ever did. Like, I can't do middle school or below. I just don't like those kids. I barely like them as freshmen and sophomores. And then junior year, I'm like, now we're fine. So I've never gone younger.
Similar experience because I have no younger siblings. I have a nephew now, who I've seen once as a baby, and I'll be seeing him again this Christmas. He's like one now. And I'm super excited about that, but I've had very little experience with small children, and it was always amusing because most of my work, with church has been with teenagers and mostly high school age. But I've always sort of been the opposite of so many parents and other people where, most people, they're really great with kids. Most people who work in youth ministry are really great with kids. And then once they hit like 13, 14, it's like they have no idea how to communicate anymore. And I was always the complete opposite. I still don't know how to talk to, I'm talking to a 6-year-old. I'm just like, so what do you do? I don't know how to talk to them.
No. Well, but I have 3 god kids, and one of the things I love about my god kids is I'm the same way. I can't talk to a kid like a kid. But I will ask them pertinent questions as if they were a real human, and at some point they learn to answer them. And before most kids their age learn to answer them. So I love that. And again, this is something you can feel free to say no to, and I will cut it out later. But were you out when you were doing that ministry?
Yes, I was. And actually the first gay kiss I had was while I was, in, in the, I was a teenager. Let me clarify that.
Well, I mean,
but yeah, when I was in the youth
program, I grew up Catholic. Plenty of us had our first gay kisses at church events. Don't worry about it.
But yeah. And that was one of the things that I, appreciated. And that's not to say that I didn't still deal with, some irrational concerns revolving around my sexual orientation. But one of the things that I did always appreciate about the church environment that I grew up in and was involved in was that homosexuality wasn't a big deal. We had a actually when I was I was high school, like 2000 to 2004, and we had a transgender youth back then. And that was and she was perfectly well accepted. There was a little bit of drama in figuring out where to house her, with the boys or with the girls. But yeah, it's always been a very accepting environment. And I always really was thankful for that.
That's awesome. Okay. So about the speech thing, you said you did that in college, or did you start in high school?
I started in high school.
Okay.
And then there was sort of a big gap between graduating high school and going to college. And then I got back involved with it in college.
So what were your categories? What'd you do?
Mostly speech. I did persuasion, info, communications analysis, or retcrit. What was the other? We always called it on our circuits. It was called communications analysis, but there were other ones that was like, it was rhetorical criticism or something like that. But okay, you speak about some sort of artifact of communication. And then I did impromptu speaking. I tried extemporaneous speaking a couple times, and that was miserable.
It is, even when you're good at it.
Yeah. And then I did some oral interpretation. I did prose.
I was wondering when the interpretation was going to come in, dude.
Yeah, the oral interpretation definitely happened. And for those who don't know what we're talking about, because we're using our terms.
Oh, God, oral interpretation probably sounds dirty to people who listen to a couple gay book narrators. Yes.
Oral interpretation is the sort of live reading and performance of a written work. And so the different competition categories were broken up by the type of work, whether it was a work of prose or poetry or a cutting of various programmed oral interpretation. You could do different things, or it was drama, but you'd cut a piece down to under 10 minutes and give this sort of live dramatic performance that was, you know, 90% about your vocal telling of it. And what was funny is that, I mean, obviously that instills a lot of great, there's a lot of really obvious crossover with audiobook narration.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what we're doing, is oral interpretation of literature. And so there's a lot of the pitfalls that new narrators fall into when it comes to voicing the opposite gender, or doing various character voices. You know, you and I have had lots of experience sort of working on that and helping other people work on that. I did a little bit for a while. But what was always amusing to me is that I always sort of struggled in oral interp at tournaments. I would either not break, or I'd break, but I'd get like fifth in finals. And what it was is that I never went big enough for what forensics wanted. The judges always wanted this like really big performance, and I was always a bit too subdued for what everybody was looking for, which in the world of audiobooks, you don't want to go too big,
right?
And so actually my approach translated really well into doing audiobooks, and it makes sense, because I mean, if you know, listening to 10 minutes of audio, you can handle a lot more sort of big characterizations and sort of big dramatic things versus listening for 10, 12 hours.
Right.
It can be a bit much.
And this is while you were in Jacksonville when you were younger?
Yeah, this is while I was in Jacksonville, going to community college. And then when I came to Tallahassee to finish my degree, I never ended up joining forensics at at FSU.
I didn't even know collegiate forensics was a thing when I graduated from high school, which is how sad it is. I mean, there's pockets of it across the U.S. So, I know Florida is a pocket that it can get real competitive. So to even see the inside of a final round is an accomplishment when many of us in the Midwest, I mean, we have it, and it's, you know, there's some programs sprinkled throughout Wisconsin and Minnesota and Chicago that are strong. Most of the time, if we're seeing a final round, it's not because we're going up against the best of the best. And then we get to nationals and we have our asses handed to us and we go, oh, that's good. But it's also so much bigger than our Midwestern sensibilities were always a little knocked off kilter when we went to nationals, because it was like, oh, that's a lot. So, but okay. They like that. So that's awesome. So what is the best job you've ever had?
Working at San Marco Theater in Jacksonville, Florida. I was 18, and it was this little single screen movie theater, and with like a full kitchen, and so you could order like pizza. We did like toasted sandwiches, nachos. We had 5 beers on draft, a couple different wines, and this was still, you know, it was a projector up front, so it was big like platter projection. We'd splice all the reels together and roll those. And that was just glorious, for so many reasons. For one thing, once the movie started playing and everybody sort of got their food, you had like a solid hour where, like, other than cleaning up a few things, you didn't really have to do anything. The owner was real laid back, so we could just, you know, we'd just make our own food and, hang out. I had one day I showed up, and I was feeling real sick and miserable, and so after the first showing, manager told me to go lay down on the couch upstairs. Went, laid down, took a nap. He woke me up like 7 hours later at the end of, like, after they were done cleaning up the theater. He was like, all right, you can clock out now. When we built up a film, you had to watch it to make sure that you didn't accidentally put a reel in upside down or something like that. So we'd always do that after hours, and we were allowed to, you know, bring in our friends, and we'd just pour some beers and smoke and watch a film in the theater all to ourselves. And it was just glorious, you know, minimum wage. I wouldn't go back to it now, right. But that's, I think that's easily one of the most, enjoyable jobs I've had.
What's the worst job?
A lot of good memories. Worst job was, I was a pet sitter, and that wasn't too bad, but then I started working at this little doggy daycare facility. And, I've done a lot of, food service industry, restaurant stuff, retail, where, you know, you have like annoying people who yell at you and customers who have, you know, outlandish requests. And I always thought that was annoying, but being by yourself and having 12 dogs barking at you all day long for, you know, they all want food and play and to be out at the same time. That one, I like animals, but that was not a good fit for me.
So, okay. You did such a good job of summarizing your life up until the point where you started doing audiobooks. When were you first exposed to one Mr. T.J. Klune?
TJ Klune, all right, this is a story, because this is actually kind of a big deal with my trajectory in audiobooks. When I was very first thinking about getting on the other side of sort of audiobooks, of narrating myself, I learned about ACX, and actually Elizabeth lent me a microphone that she had, or it might have been one of her sons. And I like looked up YouTube instructions on like making a little sound thing. I had this like plastic tub with like a mattress topper inside of it. And the microphone was just a little like Yeti Blue USB microphone that I plugged into my like super noisy laptop. But I was, you know, I created an account on ACX. I was looking at listings, and actually, what happened was my dad, whose name is Tommy, got cancer. And it hit, we found out about it real suddenly. He came to, he came up for my graduation from college, and was great and healthy. Came up for my birthday 2 months later and was just super scrawny, big, inflamed belly. And I begged him to go see a doctor, and it turned out that he had advanced colon cancer. And so while he was in the hospital getting that removed, I was down visiting him, and I was staying in his trailer. And at night, like, I couldn't really sleep. And so I was looking at auditions on ACX, and I was reading through some of the audition scripts, and it was Tell Me It's Real by TJ. I recorded an audition for that maybe like 50 times, like, and it was just such a wonderful, and that was like really my first introduction to TJ, was reading through like this first chapter 20 different times and absolutely loving it and laughing out loud and loving the realness and authenticity of this character, and just the you know, this bluntness and insecurity and all this other stuff. And I never submitted that audition. It was horrible.
No?
Oh, it was so bad.
Did you know if it was so early in your career? Like, how did you know it was good and bad?
Well, I knew it wasn't great at the time. And now I'm sure it would be even way worse. I mean, forget the performance aspect. It was echoey. The fan was going, I'm like stressed and emotional, like going between crying and freaking out. My dad was a heavy smoker. I was chain smoking at that point in time. It was wheezy, and it was, it was horrible. So I never submitted that one, but it always stuck out to me, like, oh my goodness, this writing, really hit me. And then, after I got, you know, started getting into all of the audiobook narration stuff, and had a much better setup, and started learning a little bit more about what I was doing. I remember Lightning Struck Heart came up for auditions. And part of what I loved about that was that all of a sudden, because, you know, there's some Facebook groups for narrators. Mm-hmm. And there was just this massive buzz all of a sudden about The Lightning Struck Heart. And I know that there are all of these narrators who have never touched gay romance who auditioned for it, just because reading that audition script, everyone just like fell in love with it. And like people posted it on these narrator groups, like, you need to check out this audition listing. And I did record an audition for that. And I tried really hard, and TJ will confirm that my audition was absolutely horrible. I was not a good fit for that book. And Michael Leslie has just done such a phenomenal job with that, with that series. And you know, I remember when it came out, and I listened to his performance, because of course I was disappointed. You know, this is, you know, I'm a big fantasy junkie and everything else too. But I remember when that came out, I was like, oh no, yep, this was the right call. This was very good. So then eventually but at that point I was sort of auditioning anything of TJ's that came up, I had to audition for it. And then, How to Be a Normal Person came along, and fortunately, TJ is a true professional and did not let my past horrible audition alter his interpretation, listening of that, and that ended up being a really great fit, and I love that story, and it was there were a lot of aspects of it that had sort of eerie connections to my own life, and so I felt very very deeply connected to it. There was, you know, some significant differences too, but I still felt really connected to it and really loved it, and I'm really excited that he went ahead and broke down and is continuing in that world, So I will be able to go back on some more Mountain Town adventures.
You're getting a sequel. Before we talk about that, though, like, is the, I mean, yeah. The fact that you had some personal connection to that material, is there any way he could have known that?
No, not at all.
So
not
he,
at the time.
Yeah, he seems to just have this innate sixth sense to be able to hear something in an audition that connects with him on a level that means the work will ultimately be successful.
Well, I think part of it too is even just the fact that, you know, as a performer, when you have that, you know, you always try to connect with everything that you're performing, but when it's just real explicit in your face, I mean, this was still not that long. I was still dealing with my father passed away. Mm-hmm. And, so in How to Be a Normal Person, this is, you know, first of all, if anybody listening to this hasn't read or listened to How to Be a Normal Person yet, get on it. But this is going to be very light spoilers, because it's all stuff that's real, real early established. Mm-hmm. But the main character, Gus, his father is Tommy. My father is Tommy. His father died from cancer. My father had recently died from cancer. His father had recently died from cancer. And when I went to his house after he had passed, you know, he had a little pipe right by his chair where he had gone away. And Tommy in the book is, of course, a big heavy mm-hmm. smoker. If you've seen the cover of How to Be a Normal Person, marijuana does come into play.
Oh, is that what that is?
It's yeah, that is a marijuana leaf, and that illicit substance does play some part in the tale of How to Be a Normal Person.
That's amazing.
But yeah, and there were another number of other sort of connections, and in some ways, I have a lot of differences with Gus, but I also have some similarities. Casey is the other main character and romance interest, and Casey and I have a number of differences, mostly dealing with, you know, Casey is an asexual, and that's part of what was super awesome about How to Be a Normal Person was being able to help bring a little bit more exposure in this really authentic telling of asexuality, mm-hmm. In a way that wasn't, that was just brilliantly not like preachy at all. Cause it's a TJ Klune world. So there's right. you know, just all sorts of just fun and craziness, but authenticity at the same time. And I'm really looking forward to exploring more of the amigos and going to Josiah's story, because I feel like it's inevitable that I'm gonna find some more connections with these guys.
Sure. Well, I mean, it helps when you have good writing, which you always have with TJ, and like he seems to just be getting better and better. So I actually, when all is said and done, I would love to talk to you again about what it's like approaching this sequel when there has been so much time in between the two.
Yeah. I mean, we can talk about that now if you want, but
I was going to say how much
I don't have a script yet.
I was going to say I wouldn't imagine that, you know, all the details, but has he done that really fun thing where he sends you an email and is like, how much do you want to know? How much can I ruin this for you?
No, not yet. Okay. I mean, How to Be a Normal Person isn't as, you know, that, and this, you know, we'll see what happens. I haven't read it yet, but it's, you know, obviously it's sort of naturally called a sequel, but because Normal Person wasn't written to be a series, mm-hmm. It's also not one of those where, you know, everything's sort of been wrapped up nicely. So now we're going and really just sort of returning to that world, presumably, mm-hmm. and seeing what happens with some of the other characters that we've, been introduced to. So, and it's, you know, the nature of the contemporary. There's not as much drama and suspense as you get with a paranormal, such as Wolf Song and
sure.
Raven Song and Love Song.
Yeah. So what do you know? What can you tell us? What can you tease?
I know that the sequel is called How to Be a Movie Star. I know that it focuses on Josiah. Is of course a star. is an actor and enjoys performing. Very close friends with Casey. I know that Josiah is identifies as a demisexual. I say I know. If I remember correctly, he identifies as a demisexual.
Oh my God! What if you got that wrong just now?
So that would
people
be,
will be screaming
super,
at their iPhones. Inspired.
Look forward to How to Be a Movie Star, narrated by Michael Leslie. Yeah. But no, yeah. As I recall, he's a demisexual. So that'd be cool to get again this sort of exposure to. I hate to call them orientations, but to these. To these ways of being and ways mm-hmm. of loving that aren't as mainstream or well understood. I also know that he's called Josie for short because his name is Josiah. Mm-hmm. And I know that throughout How to Be a Normal Person, I pronounced his name Hosiah.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Found that one out a little late. And I've been debating about trying to go back and re-record all of those lines. And then if I do that, why don't I just go ahead and remaster all of How to Be a Normal Person? But so many people listen to it multiple times that I'm almost scared to do anything to it.
Yeah.
So that's actually one of my current debates. So yeah, let me know what you think, listeners, whether I should go back and fix that or just don't touch it.
Fascinating.
It's a tough decision. And yeah, obviously what I would need to do first and foremost is, you know, correcting it might not even be a realistic option.
Because I was going to say with the equipment that you've undoubtedly updated,
my space has changed. Obviously there's a part of you that just is like, so people really like How to Be a Normal Person. That's awesome. And it makes me feel really good. I feel like I could do it so much better now. But I know it is what it is. I loved performing it. And I'm really looking forward to returning to that world. But yeah, it's very likely that, you know, if I were to try and change it, I would have to do some tests and it's very possible I couldn't get an effective voice match. So, in that case, we're just going to have to live with the fact that, you know, from, How to Be a Normal Person sort of alters perspective a bit. And you know, maybe, you know, there's some explanation of just a misunderstanding, in our other characters' lives. I don't know.
I feel like if anybody's, listeners/readers would be understanding, it would be TJ's. They'll get it. I mean, this is probably more inside baseball than most people who just listen to audiobooks casually care about, but that progression as you learn so much more. I mean, I'm only 15 books in at this point and Wolf Song was number one. Mm-hmm. And, with doing the sequel right now and having to go back and listen, I was like, well, you know what? It's time to go and listen to it so that I have it in, you know, in my head again. And I couldn't, mm-hmm. I could not listen to my own performance. Listeners, again, exactly what Derek just said. I know you love it. I'm so happy you love it. I know what I know now.
I know what I know now. That's one of the it's one of the struggles that I have with being more prolific, because I am one of the for people who don't have a day job, I record and release fewer audiobooks than most people who don't have a day job. I mean, obviously most people who this is their day job. Mm-hmm. This is my day job. And my night job and
your weekend job and your holiday job. And yeah.
But you know, one of the struggles that I always have to get over is, you know, not re-recording the same thing over and over again to get it just right. And then sometimes you just have to just let it go and let it be good enough and realize that you're getting to a level of perfection that only you will know any difference. Mm-hmm. I'm at a point, I've done enough, even before I started doing this, I've done enough public speaking that I can handle hearing the sound of my own voice.
Right.
And that in and of itself isn't an issue. And, I'm sort of always constantly even right now as we're talking, just the way that I have my audio set up in the computer, I can hear myself in the headphones. Mm-hmm. And people who aren't, who don't do this sort of work, that, you know, throws them way off, because obviously how our voices actually sound is different than how we hear it without monitoring. But I still can't sit down and listen to the entirety of one of my performances. I have to outsource all of my proofing. I cannot proof my own stuff. And it's just a really weird, it's still just such a weird experience to hear that. And it's, you know, you can't turn off that director ear, that wants to, you know, no, you need to pause just a little bit more there.
Right.
You need to, you know, hit the wrong word. What were you doing? So it's
the yeah. thing that took me the longest to to internalize is the best way to put it, is coming from the world of forensics, where you always have another chance. And it's usually like you get to do it an hour later and you get to try it again, was actually discovering like, oh, this is set in stone. It's done
and that's,
now.
One of my other struggles with getting stuff done is that there's almost this anxiety before I hit record.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't have it for book one.
Uh-huh.
But starting for book two, it was like, oh, wait, because I mean, I had to, when Wolf Song came out, it was a thing that I didn't know was going to be a thing. And like people were asking me for like samples so they can run it on their blog. And I was like, oh, okay. So like in that way, I had to go back and listen to myself. And I was like, oh, I would do that differently. Oh, I would do that. I would do that differently. And it was just this learning curve of like, oh, this is forever. Maybe I should have brought that critical ear to it in a way that I don't always, right. Because I'm used to.
Don't fall down my rabbit hole.
You'll perform this 40,000. Well, you're doing that, but I also like I work with Joel Leslie as a coach, and he says he's very much the same way, that he's very, very critical. So I'm actually learning to be more critical. But when to cut that off so I can still get something done.
Joel is very self-critical, and that is true. He and I have been very sort of supportive to each other and communicative since we started at about the same time. When he first started, because we started at roughly the same time, and we connected when we were both just sort of a handful of books in. And he used to be so jealous of me. Because I was narrating at like union rates for Josh Lanyon Joel is like earphone winner, working for like major studios, has 100-something titles done, and part of it is work ethic, part of it is a spouse that actively engages in supporting Rich, helps with post production.
Mm-hmm.
Alex is sick of the sound of my voice. He hears it every day and he doesn't want to have anything to do with what I do. But anyway, but part of it is,
has he listened to a whole audiobook?
Oh, no.
No, not a whole one? Okay.
No,
I don't feel so bad then. I got mine to listen to one.
Oh, that is awesome. I can't even get him to listen to other people's audiobooks. I tried to listen to Lightning Struck Heart on a road trip and
for shame.
Going crazy. He couldn't do it. He can't listen to any audiobook. He wants his show tunes and his 90s club hits. So
okay, you know what? Can't blame him for that. Can't be mad. You know? Can't be mad about it.
Can't be mad about that. But no, yeah, and Joel's such a hard worker and puts in so many hours. It's really impressive.
Indeed. So as somebody who has actually gotten to meet TJ Klune and spend some time with him in person, for the benefit of those of us who have not, what's he like?
Worst person ever. Huge ego, very aggressive. No.
It comes across in his social media presence that he's just really aloof.
No, he's great. TJ's, he's definitely, he's a fascinating character and he's a great person. There's just this rich depth to him. And, I think he's more reserved than I at first expected him to be. And one of the things about TJ is that he's far more, while being totally authentic, he's far more professional, and put together than, I would, almost expect from his dialogue in his books. But you can see that when you look at the larger career of TJ, of you know, that the success that he's enjoyed and been enjoying, and the progressions that he's made really show this seriousness of craft that comes across in that. So he's super friendly. He's super nice. He can get, you know, like all of us can get a little overwhelmed at times. And people love to, you know, how can you not fanboy with TJ, but just take a deep breath and, you know, make an introduction and he's happy to take selfies and he can be real good and engaging. And, if you're like me, you know, Kurt, you'll probably get a chance, to grab some drinks with him and Michael. And you know, maybe if you happen to order a double tall gin and tonic at last call, he might give you a hard time about that for quite a while.
Oh, really?
yeah, we had a blast. And Michael Leslie's, a blast too. I don't know if you've had a chance to meet him yet.
Not yet. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, he's a lot of fun. Grab some hot goss. I can't make it to GRL this year, so you guys gotta get the hot goss together in my place.
We will represent as best we can. So you mentioned, or I mentioned, I guess, at the beginning of the episode about this new business that you've started, Wildwood.
Wildwood Audio, yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess, what was the impetus of that? And is that, like, the type of work that you want to continue doing? And kind of tied into that, like, what's the dream? What's the goal? Like, if you could be the architect of your life and have things work out perfectly, where are you in 10 years?
Okay. All right. So Wildwood Audio has been born out of a number of things. And basically, you know, when I got started in this whole audiobook thing, like I said, I was proofing. The very first thing I was doing in the audiobook world was proofing for Dream Spinner Press, proofing for a small publisher. And then I got involved with narration, and I've gotten to know a lot of authors who are self-published or published with small publishers. I've gotten to know some other small publishers. And I've also gotten to know a lot more about the audiobook industry as a whole. And we had some, for various reasons, I got back into proofing about a year ago, and was doing both my own independent proofing work as well as proofing for a couple major studios. And that also gave me a lot more exposure to various aspects of the industry. And sort of all throughout this time, I kept having all these sort of thoughts about things that could be done, and realizing that basically what there was and what there is a lack of, in my perspective within the audiobook industry, is more of a professional level services for the indie author, the small publisher, the home studio narrator, that's able to sort of recognize the realities of that world and sort of meet those realities. Most of your companies are really focused on the big five publishers. And for good reason, they're the ones with the giant freaking budgets. And, you know, and there's a lot of sort of misconceptions about the business of audiobooks. There's misconception about the business of books itself. And so even these big five publishers, are oftentimes, you know, losing money on a number of their audiobook productions. But their big sellers are such big sellers that they can afford to spend those sort of vast amounts of money on that. And so all of this is sort of, if I can, I'll jump to the big dream of Wildwood, and then I'll go back to what Wildwood is today.
Okay.
The big dream of Wildwood is what I would really love to eventually do and primarily focus on doing with Wildwood Audio is audiobook management for small publishers and independent authors where we would be able to work with them to evaluate titles for audiobook success, evaluate the publisher or the author's goals, and basically then work within their budget to create and to best meet their goals and to create the best possible audiobook production that can be accomplished. And we wouldn't be a full studio. I would instead utilize other resources and home narrators and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And we'd be working within that budget and with our understanding of the audiobook industry, with our understanding of listeners and distributors and the technical side of things, really sort of finding the best ways to maximize the mileage on each of those budget dollars while still being fair and appropriate to those who do the work in a way that doesn't hurt the industry. And that's mm-hmm. something that doesn't really exist right now because it's not easy. Mm-hmm. So I'm just really fascinated by this. And I have this, this firm belief that it's possible far more so than some people think it is, to put together a really high quality audiobook production, on a relative budget. Mm-hmm. Still not, it's never cheap to make audiobooks, but on what's relatively, a budgeted thing and in a way that can be profitable, and finding those ways to sort of maximize that profit because, the authors deserve to be able to keep writing and doing these things. So right now where I'm at with all of it is sort of very, very elementary level. We offer proofing services, for, narrators, as well as for, authors and small publishers where we would do for them, it looks a little bit different proofing for, so for the listener's sake, proofing for a narrator and proofing for an author or publisher is a little bit different because with the narrator, we're working on it during their production process. And so we tend to be, the way that you approach that is, with a much sort of stricter eye, and sort of like your copy editing phase where you're identifying all these, every single little error that exists. And then there's that final quality check proofing, which is what we do for, authors and publishers, which is that their, producer or narrator has submitted their final fully produced audio. And we check that for any remaining big issues. So if the narrator says, the ship was tossed by the storm instead of the ship was tossed by the tempest, we might not ask that be changed. We might not mark that because, it's a word change. Yeah, tempest sounds way better, but, the listener isn't going to really pick up on the difference. But if they say, he walked into the chicken instead of he walked into the kitchen, that needs to be fixed. And so that's the sort of those major errors that are just embarrassing if they make it into the final. And there are almost always it's amazing what can come out of our mouths. So we do that.
We don't. Sounded perfectly natural. He walked into the chicken. Right?
Yeah. And that's actually, I mentioned, it's one of my go-to examples because it happens way more than anybody.
I believe
imagined.
It. Yeah.
Like it sounds outlandish, but there are like big name narrators, that like they don't do independent work and I've working for studios, I've been like, yes, said chicken instead of kitchen again. it's just weird things our brain does. And then we also now are offering, full post-production for, home studio narrators and independent producers. So, I mean, you and I are independent producers. That's what we do. We narrate for TJ when we narrate for Dream Spinner. We're not just narrating, unlike if we were hired for, an Audible Studios project or a Tantal project, we would just be narrating. We just narrate it. We send it to them. They handle all the technical stuff. When we work for authors, when we work independently, we're doing everything. And there's a lot of editing and post-production, you know, it takes a lot of work to make us sound this good. And
yeah,
so that's something that
Wild Natural
is now doing. And I'm sort of building up the roster for those. And so in the short term, I'm offering those things, but they would eventually fit into that big dream plan of audiobook management, because by the time I officially launched that, I would have this roster of post-production professionals who I'm able to get at cost. So it's just another little budget saving measure.
And it's such an art. I mean, the learning curve for just learning how to make my own voice sound good has been 2 years long, and it's in hundreds of hours and a lot of money. Talking to people who know way more than me. So like, I feel like I'm at a point now, 2 years later, where I can make myself sound pretty good. Mm-hmm. I would have no idea where to start.
Yeah.
If I lost my stacks that somebody else made for me that make me sound good, I wouldn't know where to begin to like recreate that. Somebody who knows more has taught me to do this, and I can, and the sound quality is better now than it was 2 years ago. Again, if I could re-record Wolf Song, I mean, I wouldn't, because it's a 20-hour book, and I'm not doing that again. but to learn it for myself is so much that there are people out there who are so good at what they do, and it is such a mix of technical knowledge and artistry, and that they can like, oh yeah, this is your voice, and this is what it sounds like, and there you go.
Yeah.
Now you sound great.
I've struggled with things that then I'll send off to, you know, an engineer friend or something, and what took me 2 hours to not fix, they're like, oh yeah, here. And 10 minutes later, they've got it back to me. It's like, all right, I need to stop trying to do this myself.
Yeah.
Now, as far as Wildwood goes, I do fully intend on continuing to narrate. But part of the dream is that I can continue to narrate at sort of the pace that I have been narrating, sort of get away with that professionally, to not have to be able to finish 4 books a month, because that's something that I've tried to do for a long time, and I keep fighting that, and it just doesn't sort of fit with me. And one of the biggest struggles for me as a narrator that I've found has been sort of living in this box by myself all the time. And I'm very socially awkward, but I'm accepting the fact that I'm also an extrovert. And so Wildwood also gives me an opportunity to have a little bit more interaction with people and a little bit more of the sort of micro satisfactions of helping people out with things. And so it's just sort of finding ways to engage in that, what I'm passionate about and what I'm comfortable with and all that jazz.
Well, awesome. I applaud you for seeing a need and making something happen and doing something really hard, because it's not easy to start a business. And so congratulations.
We'll Thank you.
Pat yourself on the back. Celebrate every victory. You're doing great. And if somebody wants to hire you, how do they find you?
Wildwoodaudio.com.
Yeah, that was a good choice, making it the name of the company.
You can also search Facebook for Wildwood Audio. You can find Derek McLean and reach out to me. Derek@wildwoodaudio.com. There's all those work.
Send a pigeon.
Right.
It'll get...
Don't send a pigeon.
No. Okay. I don't want to take up too much more of your time. So let's do some maybe more lightning round questions.
All right. I'll be quick.
This is going to come out at GRL. I've never been in like the 2 minute version. What should I expect? Or what should somebody going to GRL for the first time expect?
Lots of enthusiasm. Lots of people. The sense of actually being known. Keep your name tag out. So people know that it's Kurt Graves, that'll be exciting. And a lot of, it's a very loving place. A lot of people who are, you know, sort of they're passionate about the same thing. And one of the biggest things is don't feel like you have to conceal your excitement. Be excited, get engaged. meet people, talk to people. And also, again, we're all book people, a lot of introverts. So don't, you know, just try and push past that and say hi to someone and start up a conversation. It'll be a blast.
Cool. In your opinion, what is the best work you've done and why? Specifically in the audiobook realm. What's your best book?
Oh, God. Olive Juice by T.J. Clune is one of the proudest for me. And it's I think it's tragic. I know a lot of people sort of will not listen or read Olive Juice because they know that it's a tearjerker. Mm-hmm. And I can kind of respect that. I can absolutely respect that, but it is such a powerful story, and it's it was really, really important to and not necessarily easy to bring that story to life in a way that didn't swing too far in one way or the other. Mm-hmm. That wasn't overly dramatic, that didn't turn characters or lines into caricatures, that didn't take away from the power of the story by going too far with vocalizations, but at the same time didn't just give a plain flat read, that was able to you know, this is one of those situations where, you know, you have these lines of dialogue that are very simple words, but you know from the whole context the full sort of feeling behind those words. And so I know I worked really I did my damnedest to really honor that work, and I like to think that I at least got close enough.
Still mad at you for getting to do that one. I loved that story.
Well,
I really, really did. I am somebody who enjoys a tearjerker, and everything you just described as the challenge of that book to me is just like a delicious thing to like sink your teeth into. So I am jealous, but super happy for you. Just out of curiosity, like, what has the response been for that? Because it's such a dark story. I read it as soon as it came out, and it's beautiful.
And that's one of my biggest things, is that it is a tearjerker. It is it has tragedy to it, but it is one of the most beautiful stories that I've read too. And there's such beauty and such love, and it has such an authenticity. You know, I love literature as escape, and I love, you know, as a gay man, I love gay romance because I love being able to, you know, enter into these worlds where, you know, the bodyguard tough guy is a gay man like me, where you know, the heroes of these stories are this, but this is such the degree of realism and the reality of it is so so wonderful and so rare and such a treat, and it is really precious. It is such a beautiful story. Sorry. Anyway.
No, it's all absolutely true.
And the reception has been positive. I don't look at these days. I don't really seek out reviews anymore. But I've blog reviews I tend to see a lot more often.
Right.
When they pop up on social media or someone tags me, I'll generally take a look. And it's one of those where people have. It seems like I've done what I meant to do. Mm-hmm. And that makes me feel good, because it's again, you know, when you're working with really good writing, it both makes your job easier. But it's also almost this added pressure of, you know, you really want to do the words justice.
Right. I guess part of the reason I ask too, is it's one of those stories that strikes me as something that somebody who has read it may not be inclined to want to experience it in a more intimate way. I mean, there is a distance that you can create when you're reading something on a page, but when something's in your ear, It creates an intimacy that is sometimes hard to escape. And I mean, it's a part of the economics of being an audiobook narrator is you hope that the fans of the book buy the audiobook.
Right. So,
because like it doesn't do you any damn good if they really loved reading the book. Like, that's great. That's wonderful. That didn't help
now
me
check
at all.
It out in audio. Yeah. It's
right.
All
right.
But it's the best reread possible.
Exactly. And so many of TJ's readers do. They are devoted to him and they love the narrators that they've chosen. And that has created a world in which his books can thrive, his audiobooks can thrive. And that is one that, as jealous as I am that you got to do it, I was like, is this one that people would pick up even after they've read it? Because it's a lot. Okay. What's the audiobook, TJ or otherwise, could be anything that you wish you had narrated?
I mean, Wolf Song, Tell Me It's Real, Lightning Struck Heart, all of TJ's books.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of, you know, I wish that I could narrate The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho.
Mm.
You know, already been done, already been brilliantly done, but that book is really precious to me. And that would have been really neat. Mm-hmm. Need to give a go.
Awesome. Any other projects that you're working on that you want to let people know about that will be relevant right around the last couple weeks of October?
Sure. I mean, at the pace I work, it'll still be relevant then as it is now. I've just, by the time GRL comes around, Sylvia Violet's A Chance at Love should officially be out on Audible. If it's not, then Audible is doing something wrong, and we're going to get that fixed as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm excited about. I was really excited to work with Sylvia. This is my first title with her, and she's a fantastic author. I proofed one of her books narrated by Greg before, and she's also very her stories are very steamy, and but like. Well done, steamy. It's one of those authors, you know, that I learned from, as I like to say. Sometimes people, you know, one of the common criticisms of people who aren't familiar with gay romance is that, you know, ugh, how can women write gay sex? They, you know, these straight women know nothing about it. And it's like, well, my husband's thankful that I got exposed to this because I've learned a few things from some of these straight women. So
there you go.
Keep writing.
Sometimes it's aspirational. So.
keep researching and learning things that you can teach, you know, gay men. But yeah, no. So if you like a contemporary, that one's really good. I really love that one. And then I've got sort of a, double punch with C.S. Poe. I love C.S. Poe is one of you know, these authors that you connect with and are able to immediately meet, and Carol and I are definitely friends now, and I'm actually going to be able to going to be seeing her in just a couple days from when we're recording this, and I'm super excited to see her again. But I've got Southernmost Murder is coming out. If it's not, yeah, with my pace, it'll be coming out soon by GRL. And then I am going to be working on the next part of the Snow and Winter series. I've got a young adult, part of my genre breaking that I've got to get in, fit in.
Ooh.
In between. But that's sort of what I've got on my plate right now. And I'm freaking out about dates. They're all over the place.
Yeah.
But these are things that I'm working on. And so, yeah, so there'll be a couple CSPO coming up, and the Sylvia Violet should already be out. And yeah, I'm excited about all of it. And it's really cool to be sort of at a place now where it's, you know, it's, and before too long, I should be having another, a sequel for Reese. I'm not sure what the dates are on that, but Reese Ford, her foray into paranormal. I love my werewolves, so
yep.
that's been fun. So there's just, it's kind of exciting now at this point.
And there's plenty of them to go around.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I'm just excited about the work that I'm doing, and I like, I love it.
Awesome. Cool. All right. So the title of this podcast is Love Song, based on the short story that TJ wrote in the Green Creek universe. And I am going to ask everybody who is on, what is a love song from your life that's meaningful to you and why?
Daft Punk, Something About Us.
Okay.
And it's not, it's, you know, I've been happily married for a number of years now, but most of my romantic experience in life has been unrequited, romantic experiences. And Something About Us by Daft Punk has spoken to me in those moments. And like, not just unrequited, but like, it gets complicated. We'll get some drinks. We'll talk another time. But right. But Something About Us by Daft Punk always just sort of hits me right in the feels, right in that space that I've been at so many times. Mm. And it's definitely a love song. I would say that's the one that sort of stands out the most for me. Easy.
All right. Well, thank you so much for giving your time to this little project. And I look forward to the day when I can talk to you not through a computer screen. This has been a lot of fun.
Me too. Thanks so much for having me, Kurt. And we will definitely... you keep narrating, I'll keep narrating, and we'll keep going to conferences, and we're going to...
Our paths will cross.
Yeah, our paths will cross.
All right.
All right.
Have a good night.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
You too. Bye.
It might not be the right time. I might not be the right one. But there's something about us I want to say. 'Cause there's something between us anyway. I might not be the right one.
So one more time, I'm going to say thank you to Derek McLean for giving his time to do that interview. I hope you guys enjoyed listening to our conversation as much as I enjoyed having it. And if you haven't already, go out and buy the audiobooks of How to Be a Normal Person and Olive Juice, both narrated by the wonderful Derek McLean, available on iTunes, at Audible, and of course through Dream Spinner Press. And look for How to Be a Movie Star coming out in 2019. Up next is our conversation with Michael Leslie. I'm Kurt Graves, and this is Love Song, the podcast.